talked today, this afternoon. The first one, Igor Herbert, multi-band superconductivity and the breaking of time reversal symmetry, please.
Thank you, Anders, and thanks again to the organizers for organizing this wonderful workshop and conference and sticking to it for 2 years persistently. Of course, you know, people's interests change a bit over the years. So what I would be talking about 2 years ago really has nothing to do with what I'll be talking about today, which is maybe not fitting into the themes of the conference that well. I realized that, but on the other hand, we didn't have that many talks on superconductivity, and there is actually a fundamentally new feature for time reversal broken superconductors that I think is worth knowing anyway. So I won't feel terribly guilty for telling you something which has nothing to do with randomization group, nor gauge fields, nor emergent symmetries, which I would usually be talking about, but about superconductivity this time. So this is a work done with my then postdoc, Julia Link, who is now at Technical University in Dresden, mostly in these two, written mostly in these two publications in the last 2 years. And the work was proudly supported by the Vancouver cafes and our kitchens, where we mostly did this, all of this, because of course the university was closed for most of the time, probably like your universities as well. So we did it kind of old way, as people did physics 100 years ago. So let me tell you a little bit about the Bogoliubov of the Gent Hamiltonian in general, and what happens when the time reversal is spontaneously broken in the superconducting state. It's a very typical situation, I'll explain, but it has a very clear and completely universal consequence, which has to do with the formation of small surfaces of Bogoliubov excitations. Initially, when this was discovered by Achterberg, Brydon, and team, it was thought that inversion is a crucial ingredient of this. However, it is not, and that is the first thing I will tell you, that actually the simplest way to think about this is, in fact, the situation when you do not have inversion. And then I'll tell you a little bit about the standard case with inversion, which is also very interesting, not terribly different than the case without inversion, except that a certain object is a little bit bigger and therefore more interesting. So I'll point out some amusing and completely unexpected analogies between this quantum problem of superconducting state with classical dynamics in relativistic formulation. And if the time allows, maybe if I have 3 minutes left, I'll tell you very briefly kind of many-body aspect of this problem, which has to do with dynamical breaking of inversion symmetry when it is actually not broken manifestly by some terms. So as you know, in superconductivity works, we all learn it in school. The main thing, and historically certainly the most important feature of it, was actually the appearance of the gap, right? So when you talk about SOS superconductor, right, Bardeen, Cooper, and Schaeffer really wanted to explain the gap in the spectrum, which was seen everywhere. And that's, of course, what we call SOS superconductor. Take a piece of aluminum, that's kind of superconductor it is. Of course, now we know that there are many gapless superconductors, right? So-called unconventional superconductors. And there are hundreds, literally, if not maybe even thousands of them, right? And of course, the most interesting superconductors nowadays are typically the ones that do not have a full gap, but have some gapless points, or even gapless lines, right? So this is what we all know. And therefore, it came as a bit of a surprise to people like me who thought really understood this a couple of years ago when these three gentlemen came up and showed that, in fact, there is a whole class of problems where you actually end up with the small surfaces again in the superconducting state, quite unexpectedly. So basically, this work came out of my and Julia's desire to understand what is really the reason for this. So I hope I'll try to convey that information to you. So motivation comes from really looking at multi-component superconductors, which in general actually like breaking of time reversal. As many of you know when your group of symmetry allows more than one complex component, then typically and often in some large part of the phase diagram, time reversal symmetry breaking is actually preferred to happen spontaneously, simultaneously with the superconductivity. So here, just as an example that I won't be talking too much about, but it's an interesting example altogether, I have an example of pairing of spin 3 half Luttinger fermions in some particular three-dimensional D-wave state, which is actually some kind of tensor under SO3, and therefore has some complicated quartic term, which is like this, and has, for example, phase diagram depending on these lambdas, lambda 2 and lambda 3, which looks like this. And actually, cyclic and ferromagnetic states are both breaking time reversal. Only this real state is, in fact, preserving time reversal. So I just want to illustrate that this is a very typical situation. In fact, in large portions of phase diagrams of all multi-component superconductors, at the mean field level, you will find time reversal actually being preferred. And the reason is not very mysterious. Simply allowing relative phases between the components, typically, not always, but typically, gaps out more of Fermi surface than if you don't allow it. And that's basically the reason, right? It's simply energy. That's what's gained by this. This phase diagram, for example, was also known to Mermin a long time ago, but not to us. So we sort of rederived it, not knowing that it already existed. But anyway, so what is pairing, right? If you write down some kind of action in the superconducting state, how would you do that, right? You would basically write it down in terms of this so-called Bogoliubov-Degen Hamiltonian, right? Forming first the so-called Nambu spinner, right? So the Nambu spinner is basically your ordinary fermionic operator, Grassmann variable, if you like, with n components. N could be 2, for example, if it's spin 1/2, but could be more than 2, right? And you combine that with, let's say this is a particle, with a hole operator that we'd call it. Best way to form this hole operator, in my experience, is to actually form it with the use of the time reversal operator. So this lower component is actually time reversed copy of the upper component, right? So it's basically a conjugated psi, and there is some unitary u. For example, for spin 1/2, this will be just sigma 2. But it could be something else, right? The only important thing is that this is a fermionic time reversal that squares into minus 1, and you basically form something like this. And that's essentially the theory for how fermions essentially see the superconducting condensate, right? It gives you the spectrum of the quasi-particles. Because we formed it this particular way, you see we have upper block, which is just the ordinary fermionic Hamiltonian minus chemical potential. In the lower block, we don't have any more transpositions nor negative momenta. There is just an overall minus sign in front. So this is the simplicity bought by essentially using the time reversal operator. This is a completely standard procedure. I'm not claiming any credit for it. I think many people use it exactly like this. And this is the best way, in my opinion, to do it, simply because these diagonal blocks look the simplest possible. Okay. Now, what you have off diagonally is essentially informing you what kind of superconductor you have, right? So basically, this matrix gamma is sitting in some pairing term, right? Which, if it's local, I'll assume locality just for simplicity, looks something like this. So psi dagger gamma tau psi. So this is some kind of psi conjugated multiplied by some matrix, right? So this is a typical pairing term, right? And this matrix gamma is essentially some linear combination of whatever matrices, in fact, are even under your time reversal. Even, basically, because if they're odd, this thing would be identically zero, actually, right? Because you have the same psi here and here. You can transpose it and see whether it's the same as itself or not. And if they're not even, that would basically be zero. Okay? So what is time reversal breaking of the condensate in this language? It's basically the appearance of the imaginary part in this delta, right? If they all have the same phase, you can simply gauge it away. You can take all them to be real then. But if they don't have all the same phase, right, you cannot simply have an overall phase in front, but you have some relative phases, at least in one of these components, and that's actually what we call time reversal symmetry breaking by the condensate. So this is not manifest time reversal symmetry breaking in the single particle Hamiltonian, but actually in this off-diagonal condensate part, right? Basically chosen energetically by whatever Ginzburg-Lonau theory one wrote. So as I already said, when all of these are zero, we have time reversal. When they're not zero, one of these imaginary parts is finite. And we essentially have that this matrix gamma is not Hermitian anymore, right? There is an imaginary part times a Hermitian matrix, so overall it is not Hermitian. This is essentially tantamount to saying that there is no time reversal. Okay, so what are the eigenstates of our Hamiltonian? Well, it has some eigenstates, right, with some eigenvalues. And let me take one of these eigenstates to be at the Fermi level, right? So since I'm not assuming inversion, you see, I haven't even mentioned it so far, but I'm not assuming definitely, there is only one state necessarily at fixed p, fixed momentum, that lies at the Fermi level, not two, right? With inversion, there would be two. But But without inversion, there is only one. So let's say that's that one. I'll call it F1. I'll call that state light, because it's at the Fermi level, basically. It has zero energy relative to the Fermi level. The rest I'll call heavy, this rest, the remaining n minus 1 states, which are these blue states here. Right? So this up here is the mirror image of that. That's basically the lower block, minus h, right? That's the lower block in this block, diagonal Bogoliubov-Degen. So now I can rearrange this Bogoliubov-Degen Hamiltonian, and it turn, single out this upper block of the light states, right? So this is a 2x2 matrix. This is n minus 1 times n minus 1 matrix. And these are some 2 times n minus 1 matrices that couple light and heavy states in some way. So interesting thing is that you can say something entirely general about this Bogoliubov-Degen Hamiltonian without knowing anything else except whether time reversal is broken or not. That's essentially what I want to show. So whatever these states are, whatever is happening there, essentially there is something universal coming out. It's at a single particle level. So what is the quasi-particle spectrum? Well, the quasi-particle spectrum will be this determinant being minus omega going to zero, right? It's giving me the eigenstates of the Bogoliubov-Degen Hamiltonian. And that's what I would like to examine. Particularly, I would like to understand what happens at low energies. Right? Now, this determinant, of course, can be rewritten, you know, using the so-called Schur complement that until a couple of months ago, I must admit, even though I deal with matrices every single day for the last 30 years at least, I never heard of Schur complement before. Actually, I knew it, but not under this name. Of course, it goes back to as many good things in algebra to great Isai Schur. Right? The determinant of any matrix can be written like this. You can factor out the lower block under certain condition, and then it can be the determinant can be factored like this, where this remnant is basically your 2x2 matrix, what you had in this light sector, and then the so-called Schur complement, which is this thing here, where I need to invert this matrix here, right? So inverting, of course, the matrix is just like solving for eigenvalue spectrum, so nothing is gained automatically by this, right? But this can be certainly written this way, and this can be inverted if, of course, none of these eigenvalues are zero, and that exactly will be the case for the heavy states which are away from the Fermi level. So these all will be larger than zero, and therefore I can certainly invert this. Therefore, this determinant is certainly finite, right, at omega equal to zero. The question is really what happens in this piece here, right? That's the question. In fact, this Schur complement thing is actually equivalent to simple integration that we do every day in condensed matter physics of heavy modes, right? So what you would do by reflex, and that is to integrate out modes that are heavy or massive, in fact, would exactly automatically lead to this Schur complement, right? That is mathematics in engineering very well known. It's also connected to second order perturbation theory, actually. Okay, so we want this effective Lagrangian, right? In particular, I'm asking where omega equal to zero solutions, where they are, right? And that is actually the determinant of this effective Hamiltonian, as I will call it, which is zero frequency part of this Lagrangian, right? So this is a 2x2 object that I would have to compute somehow or find a way to say something about it, right? But it is 2x2 Hermitian matrix, right? So I can certainly expand it in terms of Pauli matrices. And the determinant of this is zero is when these coefficients combine in this beautiful way. Right? So you see that when this F naught, what multiplies the unit matrix here, is finite, there is only one condition on three components of momentum that these three components have to satisfy, and that is, of course, surface. Right? Of course, when F naught is not zero, when F naught is, sorry, zero, then I have to have this equal to zero. That's at least one, two, or three conditions, right? So that can give me full gap, point, or a line. Right? So I have to have, if I want to have a surface, I have to somehow have to argue that this is made finite by time reversal breaking. But the key is actually already present in the symmetry, as usual, right? So you find that under U1 transformation of the overall global U1 transformation of all the components, actually these coefficients transform differently, right? 0 and 3 actually do not transform, whether F1 and F2 transform, right, as a phase. And that actually tells you that if you were to do perturbation theory, you actually would find that F1 and F2 have only odd powers, because that's the only way to actually get this phase out of some of delta, whereas F0 and F3 measured from its value in the light sector would be even powers, starting with delta squared. And that is giving you the key, actually, what is basically happening, although one still has to show it, when this part, let me just go back one way, when I don't have this part, right? When I have it, and of course that's the dominant part and I have a gap. But if there is some direction in the momentum space where this is for some reason zero, right? Then these two will be order delta cube, whereas these two will be order delta squared and therefore larger. So that basically telling you that there is a disbalance between the gap, right? Which is of order delta cube, and the overall shift of this whole cone up or down, which is of order delta squared. Right? So there is a shift of the cone in the momentum direction, shift of the cone up or down by delta squared, and then a small gap of order delta cube. So when delta is small, you see, if something like this happens, I actually got a surface. Because in the special direction, I have two zero modes at P1 and P2. That's the special direction where this intra-light band contribution vanished. Right? I got two solutions at P1 and P2. Now, of course, if I vary the special direction a little bit, this P1 and P2 by continuity go around and form some sort of a surface, typically closed, actually. Right? So at small delta, if there are points where this vanishes, I will automatically end up with Bogoliubov Fermi surface without any inversion involved. And this is what one finds. Of course, when time reversal is preserved, it would have to be that somehow F0 in particular is zero, right? And that one actually doesn't end up with the surface. If one analyzes then what one ends up with, one finds basically a line of gapless points because there are two conditions. Right. So when TR is preserved, essentially one would have something like this. So I'll just in 1 minute tell you how we actually prove this. I don't want to waste too much time on this. So the way we prove this is basically by not, of course, integrating out all the heavy modes at once, which would be the same as solving the problem exactly, but by integrating them one by one. Right. So first the heaviest mode, then the next heaviest, and so on in these blocks. We have some recursion relation between the Schur complements, right? So there's a little bit kind of RG logic here. And then you find, you see that when you calculate the Schur complement, basically you have just three matrices being multiplied. And when the time reversal is preserved, you find that these three matrices that you're multiplying are all either sigma 1 or sigma 3. So when you multiply them, you always get back sigma 1 and sigma 3 and nothing else, right? So you basically cannot ever have F0 finite, and therefore surfaces are not possible. But when TR is broken, then at the first iteration, of course, you immediately get all four matrices in the game, right? Because when you have sigma 2 and you, for example, multiply sigma 1, sigma 2, and sigma 3, you get unit matrix right away, right? So at all stages, you basically get all four, and then if you do some kind of perturbation theory, you precisely find this picture that I was describing before, which is basically this. So if there's anything to keep from this talk, I think it's this simple picture, right? That at small delta, simply the opening of the gap loses compared to the overall shift, which is induced by time reversal symmetry breaking, not manifest, but in the condensate at the level of the effective Hamiltonian. That's the main simple picture that we came up with. So the way this looks, for example, in one of our examples, for example, Rarita Schwinger vial, which have two Fermi surfaces. In the ferromagnetic state, you have some little cap on the two surfaces like this. And in the cyclic state that I mentioned, which is an interesting time reversal broken state, you have very, very small surfaces. You can imagine having basically Dirac points where these surfaces are. This is like a blown up point, right? It's just like you are blowing up a balloon around the point, right? So you have a little surface. Now, the thing to keep in mind, of course, that whenever you get these surfaces, their size is actually gap squared over Fermi level, right? So they're actually small, right? So there's still an overall gain. In condensation energy because most of the old Fermi surfaces, of course, gapped, right? These are very small things, but they are surfaces, just they're small. But that's in principle how one gets them. So what happens when we do have inversion, that brings one very interesting feature to the problem. The whole mechanism works exactly the same, but there is a new algebraic twist, right, which I find very amusing. And that is that, so this is, by the way, the context in which this was first discovered by by these three gentlemen. I love the paper, and I just want to give them full credit. When you have inversion symmetry, of course, what that means is that the Hamiltonian and this gamma matrix satisfy certain symmetric equations. But unlike time reversal, you see, of course, you remember that inversion is a perfectly fine unitary symmetry, right? And time reversal, of course, is anti-unitary. So it is unitary, and not only that, right? Not only unitary, but is also observable, which is a stronger condition, right? And that's why we like to talk about parity in particle physics, for example, because the inversion we proclaim is an observable. We have a parity as a quantum number, which is plus or minus one, right? And it is an observable. Everybody agrees on that, of course. The question for us here will be, what should we assume to be the relationship between time reversal, that is, of course, the key actor in this whole story, and this inversion that now I introduced, right? And what needs to be assumed about them, I would claim, is that they always, generally, in every single situation you find, commute. So in other words, if this is some non-trivial matrix, maybe not just unit matrix, right, in some complicated basis, and you wonder what that does when you combine it with time reversal, they should commute. And in our paper, we provided many reasons why this is true on a very general level. I can just mention that, for example, if this were not true, Dirac Hamiltonian with a mass in particle physics would not have inversion and time reversal. You would have to choose between the two, right? And I think this is quite generally to be assumed for any spatial symmetry relative to time reversal. They should always commute with time reversal. In fact, I would even claim that this is the reason why time reversal has to be anti-unitary, because that's the only way it can actually not be trivial and commute with rotational group, for example. Anyway, this is certainly true in all examples that you ever heard of, but I would raise this to the level of postulate, right? I think everybody's assuming this anyway, but I have never seen it kind of explicitly stated. Here we'll really need it explicitly, right? Why? Because you see, now if I write down the BDG Hamiltonian, the old BDG Hamiltonian, in this situation, right? I just rewrote what I had before a little bit. So these are the diagonal blocks of diagonal blocks. Now I notice that because precisely of this commutation, in fact, there is a hidden operator in the game that is antilinear. It's basically sigma 2 in this Nambu index, right? Times the combination of inversion and time reversal. Now, this combination, of course, leaves the momentum invariant. It doesn't flip the momentum, right? It is anti-unitary because time reversal is anti-unitary. And when you now look at this, and you look at the Hamiltonian that either breaks or doesn't break time reversal, but preserves inversion, you find that this always anti-commutes with this Hamiltonian, right? This is actually another way to state something related to particle hole symmetry, essentially, right? But I love it this way, right? There are different ways to say it. Now, anti-commutation of this with the Hamiltonian means, of course, something that we already know, right? That the eigenlevels at fixed momentum come in pairs, one at positive energy, another one negative energy, always, at any fixed momentum. I don't need to flip the momentum to discover this. At any fixed momentum, because of this operator anti-commuting with this, I have this beautiful feature. That we know. But you take this operator and square it, right? And precisely because of this commutation, you find that actually it squares always to plus one. So this, of course, is not time reversal, right? And it doesn't commute with the Hamiltonian, as we already saw. And it doesn't square to minus one, but to plus one. Now, of course, we know that when antilinear operator squares to minus one, that implies the Cramer's degeneracy. That's what we are taught in quantum mechanics in graduate schools. But we are usually not taught that this also has a beautiful implication that is somehow implicit. There is something like that written in Messier, for example, in the old quantum mechanics, for those of you who maybe remember these old times. Of course, I don't remember them, but my father had his book since I was 5 years old, so I actually have a distinct memory of it sitting in a shelf. When this is the case, the anti-unitary operator, in fact, can be written without the unitary part. It is just complex conjugation. There is a basis in which this is true. This is a very good basis, see? In this basis, our BDG Hamiltonian is just an imaginary matrix. Of course, it's Hermitian, but it becomes completely imaginary because it has to be odd under complex conjugation, right? So now if I do the same exercise as before and look at the effective Hamiltonian, which involves this inversion of the heavy sector, right? I see that I'm here multiplying three imaginary matrices. So this is imaginary. Of course, this is imaginary. And therefore, the effective Hamiltonian, whatever it is just an imaginary matrix, Hermitian, right? It's 4 by 4 now because we have inversion. So it's actually a generator of fundamental representation of SO4, right? It's some generator, right? So I can certainly write it in terms of the generators. Let's say I call them N and J, which are written here, right? Some 4 by 4 Hermitian matrices, also all imaginary, and A and B are real. So now if I write down this Hamiltonian, I notice that in fact, you know, this Hamiltonian modulo, this imaginary unit, is just electromagnetic tensor, right? What is electromagnetic tensor doing here? Of course, this is all in momentum space, right? It's just some anti-symmetric matrix, and this is just some Hermitian matrix, which is totally imaginary. So then these coefficients A and B play the role of electric and magnetic fields in this momentum space. And therefore, I can just remind myself a little bit of SO4, which is slowly becoming my favorite algebra. It has, of course, 6 generators, which I can rewrite a little bit and factorize this SO4 into SO3 cross SO3. That's the most important fact to know about SO4. Of course, this factorization doesn't work for too many algebras, right? Maybe this is the only one of the simple, small SO algebras. So what that means is that without any work, I can immediately diagonalize the Hamiltonian because it's no harder than for Pauli matrices, right? And this is the spectrum. And I see that there are 0 modes whenever this fictitious electric field is orthogonal to the fictitious magnetic field. That's the condition for my surface. Now, if I remember Achterberg-Baydon-Thiem story, I also notice that square of this is precisely the determinant of the effective Hamiltonian. And their whole point was that the determinant is positive, but it can be written in terms of a Pfaffian squared, and this is exactly their Pfaffian, right? So this can change sign, it can be 0 somewhere, and that's the condition for the surface. So one can push this analogy a little bit further, and since I, you know, obviously have some electromagnetic tensor in the game, 4 by 4, SO4, let me just go wild with this analogy and say, okay, I'm going to even write down my wave function in this Minkowski notation, right? 0 component and some V1, 2, and 3, right? I can certainly solve the 0 modes in terms of these Vs, and I find that there are 2 eigenstates, let's say real eigenstates. One is looking like this, right? In this notation, it looks like a decent time-like 4 vector. Another one is looking like this, which in this notation looks like a not-so-decent space-like vector, right? They're, of course, orthogonal, right? And there is some connection between this V and this A and V, right? So these are the 0 modes. So what is this analogy actually, right? There is a curious resemblance between the Schrödinger equation when you have imaginary Hamiltonian. You can cancel this I that was sitting here with the I here. And your Schrödinger equation, time-dependent, looks like this, right? This F is this anti-symmetric matrix. This looks awfully similar to the Lorentz equation that actually I haven't seen for many years before I was thinking about this, which looks almost exactly the same as this for the 4 velocity, except that, of course, there is the metric tensor, G mu nu, Minkowski's, which looks like this, and it's not a unit matrix. Curious thing about the evolution, classical evolution of the 4 velocity is that, in fact, it preserves Minkowski norm. So you would say this naively Lorentz equation is some kind of Schrödinger equation. It actually preserves the norm. It is not, right? And the reason for that is that although it preserves the norm, this combination FG that sits here, right, with this G, which is not a unit matrix, when I multiply it by I, it is, of course, not Hermitian, right? And basically, this is not the Schrödinger equation precisely for this reason, and this is just rediscovering the fact that this is, of course, SO13 Lorentz group, which does not have finite dimensional unitary representations. So, however, there is still some analogy but for our 0 modes, which are such that, and that's probably the extent of this analogy, that they correspond to special velocities for which the Lorentz force vanishes in this momentum space, in this language. And that, of course, explains why electrical and magnetic field had to be orthogonal to each other. Right? In fact, one of these corresponds to physical 4 velocity that you would calculate classically. The other one does not because it has a negative Minkowski norm. and is basically allowed in quantum mechanics, which operates with a complex psi, and not in classical mechanics, which operates with real velocity. Yes, thank you. So one can find also that when time reversal is preserved, that exactly actually blocks this condition. I won't go into details. That cannot be satisfied, and one ends up with lines in general. So in last 5 minutes, excellent. I think I have enough time to say what I wanted. So let me discuss the following issue. So the net result of the breaking of time reversal in this way, with inversion, is a doubly degenerate, maybe small, but inevitable surface of wild points. Now the question one can ask, this was asked by these gentlemen here. Actually, I think Ock is not a gentleman, but a lady, woman, was very good. Is this surface stable? Right? Because maybe there is a mechanism to remove this, which is now dynamical. So we cooked up a lattice model, which I also find kind of unusual. This is a variation of the old Lieb's lattice in 3 dimensions. So basically, this is a slice of a Lieb lattice in any dimension, right? So if you pull out one of these squares from the Lieb lattice, you would find these all imaginary hoppings in some specific pattern that we basically invented for this purpose, right? And this particular lattice hopping Hamiltonian, which is 4 by 4 because the Lieb lattice has a unit cell of 4 elements, when you write it, just like Dirac Hamiltonian you would write on the honeycomb lattice, is basically some 4 by 4 effective H, right? And you can read off now, it's completely imaginary, that's the way it is constructed, because all the hopping is imaginary. All we want basically is that, you know, this is imaginary, and therefore there is an anti-unitary operator that anti-commutes with it and squares 2 plus 1. That's the only condition that we want. Right? So we can cook up some lattice theory like that, read off the electric and magnetic fields, and of course, lo and behold, find that there is some surface that corresponds to 0 modes. That's the surface. And in a Brillouin zone, basically one ends up with some bizarre object like this, right? Which is now a whole surface of Weyl fermions, right? So we are used to points, of course, of Weyl fermions. We're now even used to lines, but I don't think we are so used to surfaces of line points, but they're also perfectly possible, and here is one, right? So you take this surface, it is not a Fermi surface, it doesn't enclose any volume. Of course, it doesn't obey Luttinger's theorem, and we'll see in a second at all, right? But it is just a location of 0 modes which are crossing in energy in K-space, right? It's actually a closed surface because, of course, this plane here is the same as that one there, so there is a line like that simply that you don't see here. So it's in fact a closed surface. So the question that we asked, and I'll just tell you the result, I won't go into details, is what would happen if we would now include some interaction on this blow-up of the Bogoliubov surface, right? So we put some repulsion, and we try to do a Hartree theory for 2 fields, both of which, if finite on average, would in fact break this, as we call it, D-class condition, basically just the condition that the matrix H-effective is completely imaginary, because these would be 2 real fields, and therefore there would not be any more this condition on anti-commutation with the anti-unitary operator. Right? So this is actually somewhat involved procedure, so I'll just skip it and tell you that one of these fields is always 0, whereas the other one has a kind of generic weak coupling instability, just like BCS, right? With some complicated effective density of states that involves some projection of this Minkowski G on the Fermi surface. There is a little bit of a complicated procedure how to get this, but this N naught is finite, at least in our model always, and there is always an instability at infinitesimal favorable interaction for this to happen. So there is no critical point, but there is an instability. One can look at the critical Hamiltonian, then find its eigenvalues, and find that now 0 modes are located at these locations. So this was previously 0 when v were 0, but now when v are finite, you see this could be satisfied if this is positive, or maybe not. When this is negative, then there will be no solutions. So some parts of the Fermi surface, for example, when this is negative, on the old Fermi surface will be gapped, whereas the rest will be split. And that will probably be my final slide. I hope I'm doing fine on time. So the result in general, I think, for this Bogoliubov Fermi surfaces with inversion is that interactions, and I now cannot quite tell for a realistic system what sort of real interaction should really do this. But one can certainly, in a model put in by hand interaction, that will, when infinitesimal, split and gap the surface. Right? So our old surface, which is in blue here, now has this ugly growth on it. Right? So the corners are those that are actually gapped, but the interior is simply split. Right? So I assume V to be relatively small, so it just still resembles a little bit the old surface. But the new surface that is still there, and in fact the narrow lattice model is always there, you cannot get rid of the surface, but you can make it small, is non-degenerate. Right? So the result of interactions seems to be, if they had the wrong sign, of course the result would be null. But if they had the right sign, the result is the partial removal of the surface. So to conclude, finally, I think I'm doing okay on time. Right? Time reversal symmetry breaking by the condensate, not manifest explicit symmetry breaking by the magnetic field, for example, but by the condensate implies surfaces of Bogoliubov excitations, typically. Now, this can be avoided if these directions that I was talking about, where the direct contribution of order delta, where that vanishes, if these directions do not exist, then this can be avoided, and also may be avoided by a large gap, right, where the gap becomes large. In fact, that will push these two points above chemical potential. We also can end up without any surface. But at weak coupling, at weak gap, in most situations, this will happen precisely to the mechanism that I just described. And basically, I think this is the most economic way to think about it. One essentially doesn't care about heavy modes. One wants just the effective theory as usual for the light modes, and one just has to see what it is and understand that, in fact, it inherits whatever the symmetry heavy modes had. So if they didn't have time reversal, effective Hamiltonian will know this. So with inversion preserved, effective Hamiltonian turns out to be a funny 4x4 Hamiltonian. It happens to be a generator of SO4, which in fact allows us to think about this in parallel with the classical dynamics of the Lorentz under some Lorentz force in the momentum space, which is somewhat amusing. And finally, what I said is that inversion, even if present, is in great danger of being spontaneously broken by the residual interactions. And I think this will be a very typical situation. However, even when that happens, the surface is not completely removed, but reduced in size. It was small to begin with. It will be further reduced. At least in our lattice model, it is never removed. And essentially, the result after the spontaneous breaking is very much like if we didn't have inversion at all. Right? So it basically brings us back to the origin. So let me just conclude that experimentally, probably there will be questions about that, but experimentally none of this is seen yet, and in my opinion it will be difficult to see, because the surfaces are inherently small. I mean, they exist at weak coupling, but that's exactly where they are small, right? So somehow the nature conspires a little bit against them, right? And they introduce finite density of states, but of course many other effects in superconductors introduce finite density of states, like impurities, for example, which are always present. So I think it will be very difficult to disentangle experimentally this effect from more mundane effects, so let's say, non-magnetic impurities. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, now we'll throw around some dice here. Who wants to go first?
I have a basic question. Sorry. Thanks, Igor, that was a great talk. Just wanted to ask you, so, you know, to maintain superflow, there's this argument that you need a gap. Does having these kind of excitations, would that affect the ability of a superconductor to carry a supercurrent?
It's a very good question. I'm not quite sure what the answer is. Certainly, you can have superflow for lines of nodes and points, and I think you can have superflow for this as well. But I'm not 100% certain. That's a very good question, actually.
So I actually have a question about your very first slide. You mentioned, you know, Luttinger 3/2 fermions pairing into spin 2, but then you didn't say a lot about that. So is that crucial to this whole thing?
Not at all. This is just an illustration. This is a very interesting problem in itself, actually, this tensorial superconducting order parameter. But this is not crucial. This is just an illustration that typically when you have more than one complex component, in this case you have 5, but if you have just only 2 in some other case, you typically find a phase diagram which looks just like this. Almost everywhere you actually want to break time reversal, and there are some regions where you don't. But time reversal symmetry breaking is somehow very generic to having more than one component.
But can you say something about where do you get those Luttinger fermions from?
Well, I'll be happy to. So these Luttinger fermions, for example, arise in the for example, yttrium, platinum, bismuth, or many so-called gapless semiconductors which have spin-orbit coupling. Mm-hmm. So you actually end up with the two quadratically dispersing bands after some band inversion. So basically, the spin and the angular momentum are coupled into total angular momentum 3/2. Mm-hmm. So basically, you have two quadratic bands dispersing upward and two quadratic bands dispersing downward. Right. So it's a little bit like a bilinear graphene in three dimensions, mm-hmm. except that the total spin is 3/2. Right? Okay. And that you can pair in various channels. There is right. actually lots of literature what wins in which situation. But this is one competitive channel, mm-hmm. right? And one ends up with a very interesting field theory, which is not so easy to minimize. In fact, I don't quite understand how Mermin actually minimized this and how we minimize it. But he has a very short paper essentially getting exactly what we got, you know, a long time ago. So it's a very interesting, even at the mean field level, it's a rather non-trivial problem to solve.
Okay, other questions?
Didn't quite get the last part about this surface of Weyl points. So this was the original metallic surface. So was this already Bogolyubov? And then you have an additional instability.
That's right.
I see. Okay.
So you see, you have a Bogolyubov surface, right? It's a small surface somewhere in momentum space. Mm-hmm. So basically, we blow it up, right? How? Well, we construct some lattice model, which will have that one condition that matters. There is only one, you know, that there is some antilinear operator squared to one and anti-cumulative to the Hamiltonian. Right. So we find some realization on a lattice of that so that we simply can look at just that, right, and see whether this condition can be spontaneously broken or not. So it's like a symmetry breaking phenomenon, except that there is no symmetry. There is only something that anti-commutes with a Hamiltonian. But that condition gets broken spontaneously. Right? So it's some kind of a inverted problem, right? Inverted BCS-like logic.
Right, further questions?
So let me ask whether I understand the first point of your conclusions correctly. You're saying if you have a time reversal symmetry breaking condensate coming from spontaneous symmetry breaking, you don't get a full gap. Is that a conclusion from what you?
You most likely will not get a full gap about the Bogolyubov Fermi surface.
I'm wondering how I can bring this together with this idea of chiral supersymmetry, where you have this D plus ID, where you
Excellent
open
question.
A full gap, actually.
There you have a full gap, and that is because it's not a multi-component superconductor. There are no heavy modes to integrate. That's right. So D plus ID has a full gap, as we all know. And that was exactly my confusion initially. How can this all be true? And I know the examples where this is definitely full gap. But there has to be more than one band. So, modulo spin, of course. So there have to be heavy bands, and the integration over these heavy bands essentially transfers the time reversal breaking from the condensate to the effective Hamiltonian, at the level of which it looks like you manifestly broke time reversal and you ended up with surfaces.
Okay, I think we have time for one more question. All right, if not, let's thank Igor again.
No, thank you.